Hi, this is Steve. We were all saddened a few weeks ago to learn of the death of legendary actor John Hurt. His unique style, honesty, and deep humanity were evident in every role he played, and perhaps none of them more iconic than that of Kane in Ridley Scott's groundbreaking science fiction horror film, Alien. Now, to tell you the truth, John couldn't wait to dig into this one, but I was a little bit nervous. You see, as I've said before, horror films aren't exactly my bag, and Alien is just about as scary as they get. It also happens to be beautifully shot, incredibly acted, and filled with some of the most daring, iconic, and influential production design of any film in history. It is available for rental on iTunes and YouTube, and there is a good Blu-ray, but if you really want to dig deep and get a great deal, Amazon has reduced the price of the Alien Anthology box set down to $26.99, which has all four films plus tons of bonus features. So, that's Alien, in honor of the great John Hurt, this week on The Cinephiles.
Move! Get out of there!
What are you doing? Move! Dad! Move, Dad! Move, Dad! Get out!
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, its history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everybody. My name is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover actor and host of numerous shows here in L.A. and occasionally an actor. And I'm just super excited to do this episode today. We've gotten some really great feedback on Twitter. People, our thing is growing. And so I just am excited now to talk about another film and get into people's ears and talk about what we talk about, the themes and the meanings and all this stuff. So I'm just like really happy that people are responding to what we're doing here on the show, man.
Absolutely. It's so getting the Twitter response as a guy who's, you know, as a writer and a filmmaker, where sometimes it's months and years between when I start a project and when I get feedback on a project.
Yeah.
And frequently it's never, because most things you write, they never see the light of day.
Yeah.
To be able to create something and put it out and within an hour or two get feedback from you, I can't begin to tell you how much it means to me.
Yeah.
It's been a great journey, and today we're adding another really important film. And once again, the reason that we're getting into it is sort of sad, which is we lost a great actor, John Hurt, recently. And figured this is a good time to jump into Alien.
1979, Ridley Scott. If there's one film John Hurt is known for more than any other, it is, I think, Alien.
It's absolutely true. Yeah. But you're a big John Hurt fan, right?
I'm a massive John Hurt.
You know, and normally I'm kind of the guy who digs into like some history and background stuff. But since you were a big fan, we thought it'd be great for you to tell us a little bit about John Hurt.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. John Hurt was born on January 22nd in 1940 in Chesterfield, Derbyshire. And he's the son of Phyllis, who was an amateur actress and engineer, and Arnold Herbert Hurt, who was a mathematician and became a Church of England clergyman.
Oh, wow.
So this caused them to move around a lot, as you do, you know. And John, during one of his stops, was actually sexually abused by one of the priests.
Oh, wow.
Which we saw kind of alluded to. If you've seen Sing Street on Netflix yet, that's kind of alluded to there as well, that was very rampant in Ireland, Scotland, and England amongst the priests at that time. And so this is something that affects him as he gets older. And he goes through this, and he would say that this guy, his name is Cormac, would remove his front teeth, lick the kids. Like, it was just so weird. So this penchant for John Hurt to gravitate to these, like, unsettling roles may have started here when he was younger and experiencing this kind of thing, because quickly afterwards he becomes involved in acting. He went with his mother to the Cleethorpes Repertory Theater, but his parents actually disliked his acting ambitions. They discouraged him to do it. The headmaster discouraged him to do it, said he would never make a living out of it, but he was so obsessed with it. He kept following it, kept pursuing it through his upbringing, and then when he got to the Grimsby Art School at 17 years old, he started drawing people in the nude, started doing all these things, really got attention for it, and they offered him a scholarship, but he turned it down because he wanted to focus on acting. And finally, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art came to him in 1960 and offered him a scholarship. And he trained there for 2 years. And from there is where he kind of used that as a springboard to move into film and theater and become this actor that we know today. I mean, one of his most famous roles right off the bat is in A Man for All Seasons, going toe-to-toe with Paul Scofield in that film with the character of Richard Rich in just a few years.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I totally forgot that's him in that
film. People forget that. He was his first role, yeah. and he went toe-to-toe just playing that part really, really well. And then after that, in 1971, he plays Timothy Evans, who was hanged for murders committed by his landlord, John Christie, in 10 Rillington Place, which earns him his first BAFTA.
Oh.
And from there into the 70s, he does Quentin Crisp in The Naked Civil Servant, which gives him prominence and earns him the British Academy Television Award for Best Actor. And then 1976 is when we start to really see John Hurt, because he gets acclaim for playing Caligula in BBC's drama right. I, Claudius, which was led by Derek Jacobi, another fantastic actor right. who I'm sure we'll talk about at some point of down course. The road. And then after that, after achieving that kind of international acclaim, because I, Claudius was on PBS here in the States and people got to know all the actors that were in this, he goes and does Midnight Express, and where he wins a Golden Globe and a BAFTA and is nominated for Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. So John Hurt is slowly becoming this name that people know in these smaller parts, or these, which we'd say supporting parts. And then comes 1979, and that is when Alien happens, right? And he becomes the character of Kane, and he embodies this character so well, and we'll get to it eventually as we do the film, but this is where he starts to kind of like, what, I mean, if there's any way to announce yourself, it's having an alien explode out of your stomach, Steve.
Yeah, it's pretty big stuff.
But around this time, he also gets into voiceover. He voices the character of Aragorn on Ralph Bakshi's animated film adaptation of Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
That's him. And also in Watership Down, he plays the character of Hazel, the heroic rabbit leader. Right? So we see this. And then in 1980 comes his massive, massive part as John Merrick in The Elephant Man for David right. Lynch, opposite Anthony Hopkins. If you've never seen The Elephant Man, it is one of the most heartbreakingly fantastic yeah. films that you will ever watch, endure, and appreciate over your course of your lifetime. And John Hurt's ability to create this incredibly moving, sympathetic character of John Merrick, with the Elephant Man, with his deformations, with all the, to still, through all that makeup, still be able to see his humanity, spoke to his craft.
I can still remember the performance, and what's so amazing, and yeah. and I think that's one we should definitely do at some
yeah,
point on the show.
Absolutely.
I think I saw it once.
Yeah.
I think I saw that movie in 1980. Is that
yeah,
right?
1980.
Yeah, I think I saw it in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm 12 or 13 years old.
Yeah.
Was completely just, I don't know, affected by it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen it since.
It's a powerful film that unsettles you, because that what that man endures in that film is, if you have a heart at all, is very difficult to watch.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But it's so powerful as well.
Yeah.
And the resolution of it is so, it leaves you with an incredible effect. Throughout the rest of the few years, he plays, he's in The Austerman Weekend. He comes back to the stage and plays the fool to Laurence Olivier's King Lear, mm-hmm. then plays Winston Smith in the film adaptation of George Orwell's 1984,
right,
which achieves some notoriety in the 80s. And then he goes back to voicing over the Horned King in Disney. He's the Black Cauldron, and he plays the title role of the on-screen narrator for Jim Henson's The Storyteller, which people remember as Henson was kind of breaking out of the Muppet stuff. He was exploring all this other stuff. And then in the 90s, he shows up in Rob Roy, in Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, in Wild Bill, and in Contact, playing that reclusive right. billionaire. And then, of course, in the beginning of the 2000s, he plays Mr. Ollivander, the wand keeper, right. the wand maker, rather, in the first Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. He actually returned for Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, but all his scenes were cut out.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then he comes back for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows in Part 1 and Part 2. And, of course, for me, I have a special affinity because I am a wand keeper at the Harry Potter Land here in Los Angeles, rather. And so, for me, we've been kind of ingrained to have a special reverence for John Hurt and for the character he played in Ollivander. And, in fact, people were leaving flowers and presents all day after the day he passed from pancreatic cancer all over the park. And in Orlando, people showed up with their wands and they did a special celebration where they held the wands up for him at a certain time. Of course, he also plays Adam Sutler in V for Vendetta, which I also have right. a special affinity for and a connection with, because that's the mask I wear as the outlaw sure. when I go and compete in the Schmodown, which was I really enjoyed him in that. And of course, he shows up in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which is is probably less said about that.
Not familiar with that film.
No, not at all. Never happened. At the 65th British Academy Film Awards, Hurt won the award for Outstanding British Contribution to Cinema. And in 2013, he appeared in Doctor Who. And any of the people who are listening to us who are Doctor Who fans, you know him as the War Doctor. And he just in one appearance, he was able to create this incredible connection with the Doctor Who fans, which is very difficult to do because they're very critical of their doctors. And he was immediately accepted into the legacy of Doctor Who as the War Doctor, which was kind of this forgotten doctor that had been referenced but never really seen until John Hurt embodied him. He's got four films coming out this year in 2017. One's called That Good Night, in which he plays a terminally ill writer, and then The Darkest Hour, which he will play Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, if people remember Chamberlain from World War II and what he'd done. So he had an extensive career with numerous accolades, crossing multiple media, and left an indelible mark, I think, on a lot of people, especially for me, who have always kind of identified myself more as a character actor. When you see someone like John Hurt coming to screen, you know you're in good hands. No matter what the film is, good or bad, you always know what John Hurt's going to do is going to affect you and move you or leave you with some kind of impression. Because as I said when I gave him his eulogy on my Facebook, there's always this kind of wink in his eye, and there's something about this gravelly voice of his that was so powerful from such a frail man. It was so amazing. And if you ever want to enjoy his rendition of a poem, find the YouTube video of him doing the Jabberwocky for Charlie Rose. It will demolish you.
Oh, right. I've seen it.
It will move you, demolish you, and just give you a great glimpse or a taste of the man's talent.
You know what we should do is we should remember when we post this episode, we'll put a link to that on the Facebook page because it's definitely worth watching.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, he died, as I said, in pancreatic cancer 3 days after his 77th birthday just a few days ago.
So first of all, I'm so glad to have you do that. And what's funny is, you know, normally I try to do all my research for the show. I purposely read nothing about John Hurt.
Oh, wow. Great.
And there's so much that I didn't know about him. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you point out that's so cool is, I mean, this guy is really a character actor. He's really a supporting actor guy. And even in talking about, you know, Alien, this role that, you know, made him such a star, it's a small role.
It is.
And it's just, there's something about him which is at once sort of quirky and really natural and unusual. His take on a part is always unexpected and really natural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a fantastic actor, and it's a real loss.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's dig into Alien.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, John, how did you first come to Alien?
I came to it, I did not see it in the theater. I came to it on VHS, I guess. You know, when you're discovering and exploring films and people are telling you, you got to see this. You know, it was 1979, it's rated R, so I couldn't have gone to it. So I remember that I rented it and watched it with my brother at my house and was just blown away by the film. And it's one of the first films that I remember watching going, this is something more than just a thriller or a horror or something else. This is like a masterpiece. And so I remember understanding the idea, the concept of film as masterpiece. And this was one of these films at my very early age that was the foundation for that thought.
Well, it's definitely one of these films that that goes beyond genre.
Yeah.
You know, it turns genre into the area of great films.
Yeah.
For me, I have been waiting to tell this story. You know, when we first started doing the podcast, I was like, you know, one of my best how I came to a film is for Alien.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
I've been waiting to tell this story for a long time.
Awesome.
So same as you, movies, you know, I was a little too young to see it in the theater. My sister, however, was not too young to see it in the theater. So she's 3.5 years older than me.
Yeah.
So she's 14 or 15 when it came out. She went to see it. And then maybe the next night, she had a sleepover at her house of like her and her girlfriends.
Right.
And me, being the obnoxious younger brother, was allowed to hang out with them up to a certain point until they forced me to leave the room.
Right.
And during that point, my sister tells the story of the movie.
Oh, wow.
And my sister, really particularly at that time, could only tell a story in real time. So if she's going to tell you something that took an hour, it will take her an hour to tell the story. And she has an amazing memory. It will go into every single detail.
Wow.
And so I heard the story of Alien when I was 11 from my sister at the sleepover, and it scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I knew every single thing that happened in the movie. I didn't see the movie until I was 20 or something.
Oh, wow.
Because I was so terrified of the story. And I knew, I really, you know, and I have a good memory too, so I remembered every detail. So by the time I finally saw the movie in college, I was like, oh, yeah, I know what's going to happen. It didn't actually freak me out. My sister, who scared the crap out of me at 11, saved me from getting the crap scared out of me by the movie 10 years later. And the truth is, I haven't seen it that many times.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. This is one of those movies that everybody has seen over and over again.
Yeah.
I haven't. Maybe I've seen it three times, four times.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not a movie it's not like it's a complicated movie.
No, no.
But it's not a movie I watched over and over and over again. Part of it is not a horror guy.
Okay.
And part of it, I don't know if there's some legacy from my sister scaring me when I was a little kid, but I just never cursed me watching Alien. I've seen Aliens bunches of times.
Right. Well, Aliens is a happier film.
Oh, yeah. Because Aliens, which we'll get to, but that's an adventure film.
Yeah. It's a swashbuckling film.
It's a horror film.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's very different. So I haven't seen it that much.
Wow.
So watching it as I watched it in the last few nights, that was my first time in 10, 12, 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's get in the film.
Sure.
First of all, it comes from a script from Dan O'Bannon.
Okay.
And he had written, I think it's Dark Star, the John Carpenter film, which I saw a long, long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very little memory of.
Yeah.
And he loved the old school classic monster movies, you know, Forbidden Planet and Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
And he said, let's do that in space. And at first, it's going to be a low-budget horror movie.
Yeah.
And they're going to shop it to Roger Corman. And then a thing happens that changes everything, which is Star Wars comes out.
Yes.
And so suddenly, where science fiction had been the nobody wants to do this, this is a bunch of crap, this is kid stuff, low budget stuff, everyone goes, we need science fiction stories. And so suddenly it goes from being this low budget movie to we're going to make this for some money. They sell it to Fox. They bring in some, and I think Walter Hill is one of the producers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they bring in a bunch of different directors. Mm-hmm. Ridley Scott's not the first choice. Finally, they go to Ridley Scott. And Ridley Scott's got, you know, he's another of our big directors. This is our first time doing a film about him. And Ridley Scott, obviously born in England, his father is a army guy, so they traveled a lot. He didn't have a lot of connection with his father's kind of an absentee parent. Ridley Scott goes to art school.
Yeah.
Same thing as John Hurt.
Right.
You know, apparently these art schools in England must be really good because... You know, that's where John Lennon went. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are a lot of people
that's
where we hear this story of going to art school.
Yeah.
And he has a really strange way of becoming a director. And this is one of the things that I always tell my students is there isn't really a path to become a director.
Right.
You usually become a director by becoming something else and getting really good at it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, for instance, if you wanted to be an editor, well, you start as an intern, then you become an assistant editor, and then you become an editor on small films and maybe on some TV or reality shows,
right,
and eventually you'll become an editor.
Yeah.
You know, cinematographer, the same thing. You start working in the camera department as a PA, and then you're a loader, you learn how to be a second AC or a first AC,
right,
and you're an operator. Now you're a cinematographer. Director, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, we have directors who started as screenwriters, directors who start as actors, directors who started as editors. And Ridley Scott's a director who started in the art department.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hired by the BBC, started doing titles and set design. Eventually, that leads him into directing some television and commercials. And it's really directing commercials that he really gets noticed.
Yeah.
In particular, there is a commercial that I remember watching in the 70s, and it was the Chanel No. 5 and you go on YouTube, and I remember seeing it in the 70s, and it's this woman in a bikini, in a white bathing suit, in a pool, and I remember just going, I don't understand what this commercial means, because it was a really abstract, weird thing, and even as like a 10-year-old kid, I was like, I don't understand this commercial, and I remember talking to people about, what is this weird commercial, and part of it is, it's Ridley Scott, and this is one of the things that got him noticed.
Right.
His other, by the way, his most famous commercial is, of course, the 1984 Apple Macintosh commercial, which is aired once during the Super Bowl, never aired again.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most important commercials in the history of commercials. And that's, of course, Ridley Scott after he was already famous.
Right.
His first film that he directs is The Duelist, which is a really cool film.
Actually,
I haven't seen it in a long time. Mm-hmm. That's a really, really cool film. One I actually would like to watch again. And this is his second film.
Yeah.
We get to Alien. And man, this is a tour de force.
Absolutely. The way he directs this film, the pacing of the film, the time that it takes, the way he builds up the scares that are in the film, the way he builds up the tension, the way he lets the characters breathe throughout the film so that you can feel attached to them, so that when they do get killed or when they get, eaten or whatever you want to say by the monster, or by the alien rather, you feel that every one of their losses. And because he's given you time with them, he's given you space to breathe. I mean, stuff doesn't happen till an hour into the movie. Right. That's what's amazing. And I think you can put this with Jaws. You can put this in the same conversation in that kind of way that the alien is there, but you don't know what's going to happen until much, much later in the film.
There's no question. I think Jaws is the other important film.
Yeah.
Like, just as Star Wars is part of what makes this film what it is, Jaws is also part of what makes this film in terms of the way we treat the creature, in terms of what we show and what we don't show, in terms of, like Jaws, this is very much a 70s movie in terms of the acting.
Right.
In terms of the way you use the ensemble of characters, how they interact with each other, really comes out of that 70s style
of
acting.
In fact, at certain moments, it feels like they're improvising certain stuff, and you can see it because there's a real legitimate like anger or legitimate talking over each other that you can sense the other actors are just kind of navigating this improv situation as you would in the 70s.
Right.
And it's so great to see that, to see a snapshot of that kind of acting.
In a way, and I've seen no evidence, I've never heard it this mentioned before, but I think Robert Altman feels like a real influence in terms of the way the actors work together, is that you just sort of, you feel as if you're kind of an observer in this real life that's happening rather than this is film important moments kind of thing.
Yeah, and I would say this is almost a submarine movie. You're stuck in one kind of area trying to navigate this dangerous thing that's happening to you.
Yeah, absolutely. The other movie that I think actually has a lot to do with this, it's not an influence because it came out a year later, is The Shining, which we've already talked about. Because both this and The Shining, the fear is atmospheric. The whole way the tension is built, the pace is very slow.
Yes.
And it's really through the feeling that you get through the whole thing. It's not a bunch of things jumping out at you or super scary situations. It's a feeling that builds over a long period of time.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the sound cues, Steve. Sometimes it's the sound of the computer. It's the sound of the technical stuff in the ship. It's the sound of the exhausts. It's the sound of little things happening around you, little blips or things of that nature that you remember as a kid growing up in the 80s, the sound of computers. But this really put a fear-based atmosphere around every one of those sounds so that anything that happens just kind of increases the tension and the fear as you're watching it, you know?
So one of the key elements in pre-production was how's this movie going to look?
Yeah.
What's the design of the movie? And of course, we have Ridley Scott, who has an art background. This is a design guy. And what's interesting to me is that the key element, the most important element in terms of design, is actually found by Dan O'Bannon. So Dan O'Bannon's a screenwriter, also I think becomes a producer on the film. And he's the guy who finds Swiss surrealist artist H.R. Giger.
Right.
And I can't even begin to say the importance, the power, the disturbing nature of H.R. Giger's artwork.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any alien. Not only is there not physically an alien, but I don't think this movie is one that we'd be talking about today without Giger.
I don't think there's a movie coming out in 2017 that's part of the franchise without Giger. Yes, absolutely.
No.
His design work is so unsettling and powerful.
Yeah, it is iconic and brilliant and unexpected. And even though I've been seeing Giger artwork now for 40 years, still freaks me out. It is really, really powerful.
Yeah.
And he brings that to Ridley Scott, and Ridley Scott immediately goes, yep, that's what we're going to do.
That's what they should,
And so we go through a casting process. And part of the goal, they're doing a lot of casting the way we talk about casting today, which is I want people from different places, different looks, different... The crew, immediately you see them and you get a sense of each of these characters.
Yes, yes, right off the bat, right? You get Diafet Kodo, you get Harry Dean Stanton, you get Tom Skerritt, Veronica Cartwright.
Veronica Cartwright,
you get Sigourney Weaver, and of course, great Ian Holm. Yeah, and so each one of them embodies their physical presence and the character that they're playing so well that there is nothing that bleeds over into the other characters. Everyone is so distinctly themselves that you do not see shades of either one of them in anybody else.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is the tendency for the Monster in the House movie
yeah.
is that you have a bunch of young, attractive people.
Yes.
That's the way you normally do it. Yes. You go, we're at summer camp. We're on, out on a boat. We're in, you know, wherever
right,
we are.
Right.
And you have our young, attractive people. That ain't this movie.
No.
It's not that Sigourney Weaver maybe.
Well, of course.
And Tom Skerritt and
sure.
Veronica Cartwright are attractive people.
Sure, in their own way.
But that's not, but they're not cast to be
no.
the hot, young, sexy people.
No.
This is... And this is the key. So we open the movie, and we are waking up from some sort of suspended animation.
Right.
And we've been woken up unexpectedly because of this signal from this, maybe a distress signal from mm-hmm. this planet. And the way that it is handled, and this is so important to this film, is that space is just ordinary.
Yes.
Is that these are people.
Yep.
These are not heroes. This is a place that people live,
mm-hmm.
and everything from the design elements to the props to the dialogue to the performances is telling us these are just people on their job.
Yeah. And once again, the sound design leads you into the film. The yep. all that kind of stuff. And then the opening, the awakening, it's almost, oh, it's really interesting. It's almost like a birth
oh,
because
yeah.
you have these kind of faded images and movements and whatever as these things are opening and these pods are opening. It does.
Yeah.
It takes so this is letting you know the pace of this movie,
right.
but it's done so well that you as a viewer, you instinctively enjoy the pace right off the bat. You understand that you strap in, you are in this for a while, you know, and Kane is the first one to wake up, which is interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the whole look of the film, and this is something that starts with Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
which is previous to Star Wars, all science fiction was in this idealized world. And
yes.
People, for some reason, wore jumpsuits, and people are in these bright colors, and everything is color-coordinated. There's no dirt. Nothing is worn in. People don't have bad habits.
Right.
People's hair is all in place because that's the future in these perfect sort of worlds.
Yeah.
And when you get to Star Wars, you get to, oh, no, people live in these places, and they actually choose clothing.
Yeah.
They're not all wearing uniforms. And now, but Alien's the one that really does it because
mm-hmm.
people have baseball caps and they smoke cigarettes. Like
yeah.
that one is really like, yeah, these people smoke
yeah.
and they're dirty and they sweat and
yeah.
they're in, and this ship is not in the best shape.
Right.
And it's kind of messy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the world that we go into. And it's so, and the way they talk, and we talked about the improvisational mm-hmm. nature of it. I don't know that there's a single really important piece of dialogue that happens in the first 20 minutes of the film.
Hmm. Well, it's maybe. That's, yeah, I'm sure you're making a case for that. Sure.
I mean, we hear there's this distress
yeah.
signal.
Yeah.
We have to go, okay. There's some argument about money, you know.
Right.
There's
bonuses like, and whatever.
Bonuses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And people are bickering about stuff. And we have things we need to prepare.
I think the only important thing is that they have been... They are not at Earth. They thought they would wake up and be near Earth,
and
they're
not.
They've been yeah. diverted.
Right.
That's about the most important thing you need to know in the first 20 minutes. The ship has diverted them on its own, which is letting you know that they are not in control as much as they right. thought they were.
Right. But normally, I mean, when you're writing a screenplay, every single word
yeah.
has to be here for this reason.
Yeah.
This isn't really that.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of character backgrounds. We do get a sense of who the characters are.
Absolutely.
Without knowing, you know, and what's interesting, too, there's not a lot of heat put on Sigourney Weaver.
No.
She's just sort of an incidental
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's
just part of the crew.
Yeah. And she's a relatively unknown actress at this time.
Yep.
She's done some work on Broadway. And apparently, she's the last person cast. They had already built the sets.
Wow.
They were about to shoot when they finally cast her.
Wow.
And Ridley Scott says he knew when she walked into the room. That's what he said.
Sometimes you just know, man.
And the thing Ridley Scott is something we've talked about over and over again is he said, I had to make sure I cast the movie right. He spent months and months trying to cast the movie because once he can cast the movie, you don't have to worry about it. And with this movie, Ridley Scott is worrying about visuals. He's worried
yeah.
about the camera. He's worried about the lights. He's worried about design. He didn't want to have to worry about his actors. He did mess with his actors a lot.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
This 70s style of directing.
Yeah.
Man.
There's yeah. In a lot of ways, we'll get into some. There's
yeah.
one story that I've heard, and I cannot confirm it. I was looking around online,
okay.
trying. I was Googling this thing. I heard years ago. So somewhere out there, if you could find out whether or not this is true,
right.
let me know. First thing is that they frequently shot night shoots, even though they didn't need to.
Wow.
Which is because it's all on sets.
This right.
is all on Shepherd Studios in England. It's all shot on sets. Is that there's generally no reason to do a night shoot on a set unless yeah. you go over and you kind of go into splits and then into night shoots. There's no reason to do it because you don't have to have night. You could create night.
Yes.
He forced the actors to do night shoots so that they would be stressed out and unhappy. And then there is a rumor, and this again, this is you know, please go find out if this is true. Yeah. I don't want to say that it's true, but I remember hearing this, that he had a starter pistol with blanks.
Oh my gosh.
That he would randomly shoot at random points during the filming to keep everybody edgy and unhappy.
That would explain Veronica Cartwright's performance from beginning to end, because she is just constantly trying to run out of every situation possible. She, you know, she's an interesting character, so she's so unsettled through the whole film.
But by the way, she what she says, she thought she was playing Ripley until she got to set and found out that she was playing this other character.
No.
That's what she says.
Wow.
Yeah. Again, we get to this 70s style of director. And something that Ridley Scott says is you can be a horrible person on the route, but they will forgive you everything if you're successful at the end.
Yes.
So let's take a moment with this statement. First of all, do you think this statement is true?
I think it can apply. Yes. Yeah. I think it can be true. It can be true. That's what I would say.
Certainly, we've run up with a lot of directors who seem to, you know, Coppola and Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
Seems like he was in that philosophy.
Chaplin,
yeah. Maybe a little bit. Yeah. Stanley Kubrick.
Definitely Kubrick. Definitely. When we did Shelley Duvall, yeah.
And have we forgiven these people?
Yeah, I guess. Right? Because we weren't involved. We weren't there.
Have the people that were beat up on forgiven these people? You know, again, maybe yes. Yeah. Because it's not like John Hurt wasn't grateful for this role.
Yeah.
This role made Sigourney Weaver a star.
Absolutely.
Did she have to suffer for a couple of months to get to this point? Maybe she did.
Sometimes it's the Andy Dufresne situation. You've got to crawl through a river of 500 yards, a river of shit, to come out clean the other side. That's just how it works.
Now, that being said, as a person who teaches directors, this is not what I teach.
Of course not. You've got a good heart, so you're not going to teach them to do this kind of crap.
I wouldn't teach them this stuff.
No.
All right, so we've got this message, and we need to go land on the planet. Mm-hmm. Even the way the landing is handled, things are rickety and breaking and shaky. It isn't the Starship Enterprise, you know? It isn't even the Millennium Falcon. This is a beat up ship.
It's a freighter. It's a cargo ship, you know. Yeah. And this is what Yaphet Kotto tries to counter all the time. Like, we're not supposed to be going for this creature or whatever this thing is. We're a cargo ship. We're not equipped to do a rescue mission. And this is the whole point. This is like the crux of the entire argument throughout the whole movie. Is they were not supposed to be there, right?
What are we doing here?
Exactly.
Well, and they're not that good at this.
No,
you know,
because they're not trained to do it.
Doing things. You're like, oh, why are you doing that? which I think is a key part of a horror film is feeling that, no, don't go in the room. Don't go down there.
Right.
Don't open that door. Don't go look for the cat. You know, like, just leave.
Why are you peering into the open pod of this alien thing? Why are you doing that, John Hurt?
And this is one of the key things about horror films.
Yeah.
Is that part of what makes the horror film scary is that you know you bought a ticket to a horror film.
Yeah.
If you walked in, there's a lot, and not so much this one, but there are a lot of movies where the scene is a person is walking around the house in the dark.
Yeah.
And they walk down this hallway, and they turn this corner.
Right.
And they open up this cabinet, and then they back up for something, and then they drop something on the ground. And if you just showed someone that scene, and it may be 3 minutes long, someone watching that, if you took the music out and if you just watched that scene and you didn't know that you had bought a ticket for a horror movie, they would say, this is the most boring thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Absolutely.
Because nothing is happening. But when you know you're in a horror movie and when you hear the music, you're scared shitless because every door you open, every cabinet you move, everything you drop, every time you back up, something's going to happen.
Yep.
And so the psychology that you bring to the horror film is part of what is creating the horror film.
Absolutely. You know? It's perception, right? It's what I always tell people when people talk about how international directors sometimes can't direct American movies. And you're right, because when you go and watch a John Woo Asian film, your perception of what you're going to watch is completely different than if you go to watch a John Woo American film. John Woo is directing American films in the Asian style. Right. It doesn't work because our culture isn't built to do those and accept those kinds of things from American actors. It is from Asian actors, from Asian cinema.
Right.
So there's a whole difference. And this is what I always tell people when we talk about films and directors and why some directors don't transfer over to the American market. It's because their sensibilities don't change. Right. They're just using American people, and American people don't have the same sensibilities as their particular foreign language people do.
Well, and the other variable, this, and I'm not saying this is true about John Woo, but might be true about John Woo, most directors have a certain point where they peak.
True.
And by the time, and so he comes to the, you know, by the time a director comes to the U.S., well, their first film, maybe they're not given enough power or creative control.
Right.
And then, you know, how many good films you got in you?
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Yeah. Well, at some point, we got to get into some John Woo.
I would love to do that. The Killer is my nomination. But,
that would be The Killer.
Yeah.
That would be mine, too.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we're down on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to make the decision. Do we go out and go try to...
Right.
See what this signal is.
And we're stuck on the planet because there's a crack in the hull that's going to take 20 hours to fix.
Right.
But so they have to go out and investigate whatever's out there.
Well, they could. I mean, they don't have to.
Well, I guess well, they're required to because of the contract, right? They have to.
So we have Tom Skerritt, John Hurt, and Veronica Cartwright all go out. And Tom Skerritt, by the way, is Dallas. He's the captain of the ship. And, you know, he's one of these great, likable actors.
Really killed it in the 80s, man.
Yeah.
He was great in the 80s.
Yeah. They go out into the storm, and it is, again, this movie is atmospheric, like the sound and the light and the feeling of them going out into the storm and techniques like we're going to watch video monitor of what they're seeing while hearing the heartbeat and the heavy breathing and all this stuff. It is really scary.
It is. And it's a lot of long shots, which I like faraway shots. And also what you're talking about with the video monitor keeps like disrupting, which unsettles you immediately because you're like, I can't see what's happening. I cannot see what's happening.
That's Ridley Scott, who used an old school video camera and then filmed it with 16 millimeters. So he wanted to distort it in multiple levels.
Yeah.
And this goes back to what was learned, I think, from Jaws, is that when you look at Creature from the Black Lagoon,
right,
you're going to see this dude in a suit a lot.
Right.
And the dude in the suit's going to look stupid.
Mm-hmm.
If the shark had worked in Jaws, you would have seen the shark a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the shark would have looked stupid. The more you show the shark, the more it looks dumb.
Yeah.
Is that the lesson is that the real good fear is all created in your head.
Yeah.
And so having just starting with these video camera images that are going in and out and are distorted and you can't see what you want to see creates the imagination of the fear within me.
Yeah.
Of course, what I'm imagining, partially because I know I'm in a horror movie, is terrible.
And of course, Ash is completely calm because Ash has a whole other agenda going on that you don't know about too much later, but you sense throughout the movie.
Well, we see this just with Ian Holm's performance. He does this weird jogging thing where it's like, what? I don't know what is he doing? He just seems like this odd person.
He really does.
And we find out later, of course, there's a lot more than he's an odd person.
Exactly. But I think that's what's so great about what Ridley does here is he gives you a sense of the planet, and then he gives you a sense of how small these people are in juxtaposed to the size of the planet. This is how little control they have in the situation, walking into this situation. And as soon as they walk in and see this massive creature holding on to this, whatever it is, the spaceship, and his ribs are broken out, because of course that's going to let us know what's going to happen to John Hurt's character later. But we are immediately exposed to something that is way bigger than we had ever anticipated in a simple horror film.
And this is the first time we see Giger.
Yeah.
This is the Giger world.
Yeah.
And that big guy, they call him the space jockey. That was their nickname for him.
Yeah.
And it's never explained.
Nope. Not until Prometheus.
Yeah.
It's not explained.
Which, by the way, I've never seen.
What?
Yeah.
I don't know if I can recommend you to see it either. The jury is very, very split on that movie. So, so we see that and the amazing design. And this is what's amazing to that moment for me, Steve, is we immediately understand that this is there's more here than what we were handed at the beginning of this movie. At the beginning of this movie, it's a cargo, simple 5-6 people on a cargo ship. They're doing this rescue, blah, blah, blah. As soon as they see the exquisite design of Giger's work, we're immediately in a whole nother world, like a completely layered level world that immediately gives you an idea that there's more here than meets the eye, and there's a legacy here that we don't understand, like with Star Wars. As soon as we got onto the Death Star, we're like, whoa, what is all this from a small kid on Tatooine? You know, it's that kind of thing.
Well, and again,
there's more here.
Said it before, but I'm gonna say it again.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like Giger.
Yes.
We've never on screen or anywhere else seen anything like the world we just stepped into.
Yeah.
And this is one of the huge things that elevates this movie,
mm-hmm,
is that this is just, you could stare at those designs all day.
Oh, yeah.
One other thing I forgot to mention is that, so they're in these spacesuits.
Mm-hmm.
Those things were trouble.
Oh, yeah?
Big trouble.
Okay.
So they didn't have a lot of money and apparently didn't really care about actors' safety very much.
What do you expect?
It's the 70s. You know, they're in these sort of latex
suits with these helmets that don't have any ventilation. So as soon as they're breathing, they're filling it up with CO2. It's starting to steam up. There's condensation on the inside, and actors were passing out.
Wow.
And so, you know, and getting hot and lightheaded and just they're breathing their own breath.
Sure.
And they're just said, and he kept telling the actors, no, it's totally safe. It's totally safe. Eventually, they finally started running oxygen into the suits because, you know, you can't have actors that are getting dizzy and falling down.
Right. You get sued.
On your shoot.
Yeah.
Well, but this is, again, it's the 70s and it's, and Ridley Scott's just saying, no, it's good. It's good. Keep going. Yeah. So then John Hurt goes down into this egg chamber.
Which is, once again, a classic horror film moment. Steve, what you mentioned, why are you going down there?
Why are you alone?
Don't do that. What are you doing?
And there's one of the things they use a lot is they use a lot of smoke.
Yes.
And by the way, this is just something for all you low-budget filmmakers out there. Mm-hmm. Get a little smoke maker.
Mm-hmm.
Smoke up the room, man. It makes a big makes your crappy set look a lot better.
Yeah.
Assuming you have a reason for smoke. I mean, you can't just, we're in the baby's room, let's fill it with smoke. You can't do that. But if you're in a club or something, smoke it up. It'll make your bad set look a lot better. And it makes a great set look pretty damn amazing.
Yeah.
And then there's this weird laser effect that's right at the... So you know where that came from?
No.
This is great. So they're at Shepparton, they're shooting.
Yeah.
And who is rehearsing for their concert, like, next door at the studio?
David Bowie.
The Who.
The Who, okay.
The Who. Wow. And that laser effect, they were going to use for their concert. And Ridley Scott saw it and said, that's perfect. Can I borrow that? They said, sure. And he borrows it and uses it for this scene.
That's great.
Isn't that awesome?
That is perfect.
Then we see this egg. And again, it's like, don't get close to the egg.
Yeah.
Don't touch the egg.
And great camera work to slowly move you closer to the egg, even though you don't want to. Yeah.
And little things like the drops of liquid are coming up off the egg.
Yes.
And inside, it's semi-translucent, and there's this strange kind of movement inside.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
No.
Ridley Scott's hands.
Oh, really?
In surgical, rubber surgical gloves. Inside, he's going, I'm doing it for John. No one else
can see. Yes, it's perfect. It's great. I love it.
Yeah. That's his hands. And again, you're like, get the fuck away from the egg.
Right.
And the thing opens up.
Right.
And he's still standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And inside is, they used a lot of like sheep guts and intestines.
Oh, really?
And yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And now we have our first big scare.
Mm-hmm.
When that face sucker jumps out and hits him in the face, it is a big.
And I would argue those effects still hold up in 2017. 100%. Still believable. I know we're going to get to Blade Runner, but to me, Alien and Blade Runner, both directed by Ridley Scott, are two films that would still work in 2017 with their special effects, with their designs. I think this is what you speak about with him being going to art school first. The design of a movie stays with you longer than almost anything else because it absolutely puts you in the world of that movie, and if it's done correctly, it will leave a lasting impression on you as you go forward in life and come back and reference these movies.
Well, and I think this is something so important: is great design and attention to detail trumps technology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
you go back and look at Metropolis; that looks great. You look at 2001; that looks great.
Yes,
Star Wars looks great.
Yeah,
and part of the key is, don't show the stuff that doesn't look good.
Right.
Yes, your thing is made out of cardboard. Your set is really cheap. Show the part that looks good. Light it just right.
Yeah.
Smoke it up.
Yeah.
And it'll look great.
Yeah.
This movie, which didn't have a big budget, I think it's $9 million.
Which is amazing because it does look like it does.
It looks amazing.
Yep.
So John Hurt gets hit with the face sucker.
Yep.
And we get our first major moment from Sigourney Weaver, from Ripley.
Yes.
Which is, and I love too, one of the things that they do is he gets hit with this thing and then we cut away.
Yep.
And we don't interact with that moment at all until they're essentially knocking on the door of the Nostromo, the spaceship, to say, let us back in.
Right.
That's an amazing choice.
Okay. Agreed, man. Agreed. And it's a perfect time to like put the scare in you. And then the audience is left with, what happened? Wait, what happened? So you're having to wait. Once again, it's the pace of the film.
Right.
Ridley is taking you through these spots and trusting that his pace will keep the audience transfixed and the payoff will be worth it. And the payoff is. And because we get to that moment, what you're talking about, to me, that is the first real strong moment where we have this building tension between Ash and Ripley that starts almost near the beginning of the movie and goes all the way through until his head is lopped off. But this tension between them permeates the whole movie. And it's almost chauvinistic. It's almost chauvinistic, right, because you don't know, you know, that Ash is an alien. So when Ash defies her rule, which is Sigourney putting the hammer down, saying, I'm the, you know.
To be clear on what this moment is,
yeah,
is they want to come into the spaceship.
Yep.
And the rule is if someone is infected or there's alien life form, you have to have a 24-hour quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, no, you cannot come in.
And firmly no.
Very firm.
Even when the captain is telling her, I'm giving you a direct order. And she's like, no, because you would do the same thing if you were in my position. And she was right. And she was right.
She's 100% right.
Yep.
Well, and this is the thing we see from her, is that Ripley, particularly in this movie,
yeah,
is she's a cold, tough person.
Mm-hmm.
She is, and even, you know, I said that those first 20 minutes of dialogue, there isn't a lot important there.
Right.
There is a moment with her and Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton. We haven't talked about
Yeah.
Where they're talking about how much money we're going to get. Mm-hmm. And she is cold.
Yeah.
And tough. Not necessarily likable.
No.
You know, and this goes, you know, Hollywood always wants, I got to make this person likable. Got to be, you know, not necessarily.
Right. But I think it fits the 70s, what had been changing in the 70s, right? That vibe that everyone doesn't have to be perfect. The anti-hero, the flaws that are within the heroes was able to happen here. And Sigourney's character, like, yeah, right. That scene with Yaphet Kotto, and where she says, fuck off to them through the exhaust, right, that they can't hear. And they're purposely turning on the exhaust to mess, right, with her, because they turn it off as soon as she walks away. That says something. She knows the game they're playing, right, and she's able to hang with the boys no problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. She has a very strong, subtle performance.
Absolutely.
In this film,
mm-hmm,
that kind of arrives slowly, piece by piece. Because,
yeah,
when we get here, first of all, it's clearly an ensemble piece.
Yes.
And second of all, traditionally in science fiction, the most important character is the captain.
Yes.
But he ain't.
No. Right. You know? Right.
So Ash, who is Ian Holmes' character, disobeys Ripley's order, lets them in, and we get, and now we're going to, oh, now have you watched the director's cut?
I don't think so. How long is the director's cut?
They're almost the same length.
Okay.
And the director's cut is, like, most of the time, not a director's cut.
Okay.
And Ridley Scott thinks the theatrical cut is better, but people wanted this, and so he put in some other scenes. So,
uh-huh,
so did it have a scene where Veronica Cartwright hits Ripley?
Yes, slaps her.
That's director's cut.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay. That's a great scene.
I think it's great. That's one where I'm really happy that it's there.
Yeah, I agree.
And she really hit her, and Sigourney Weaver did not know it was coming.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
You can hear the slap, too.
It is a big...
It is legitimate. Hit. Yeah.
Yeah. And now we're going to take off the helmet, and we, for the first time, see the face sucker.
Yeah.
This might be the scariest creature I know of.
Yeah.
That thing is really, really disturbing.
The knuckles... Yeah. The way the tail wraps around his neck.
Yeah.
Anytime you try to take it off, then the acid for blood, which I think is a great moment because it bleeds through the hull, right?
Right?
It lets you know once again that they're dealing with something that they don't have the ability to understand or defeat.
Well, and it's one of those screenwriting choices that makes a negative into a positive.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is that we as the filmmakers don't want them to pull out a bunch of machine guns and have a gun battle because we don't want to do that kind of movie.
Right.
Therefore, we create acid for blood to stop. So we take this positive, which is really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he's so dangerous that his blood is acid.
Mm-hmm.
That there, and therefore we can't use guns and the stuff that we want to do.
Right.
That design, by the way, that's a Giger design that Dan O'Bannon saw. But then Dan O'Bannon, who is the writer, was also an artist, and he made adjustments to the design.
Wow. Yeah.
And it is really like the moment that they try to mess with it, and it tightens up around John Hurt's neck.
It's
really, really disturbing.
Which is a mirror for what's happening to us as we watch this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Right? With the tension.
Oh, yes. You're right.
Our throats are like we're, you know, catching our breath because we don't know what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I know that I'm watching a horror movie.
Sure.
People that are in a horror movie, they don't know they're in a horror movie.
No, they don't.
Like, you wish you could say, hey, dude, you're in a horror movie, follow horror movie rules, which I guess when you get to Scream, that's what happens.
Right, right.
But in this case, it's like, they know, okay, there's a dude with a thing on his face, and it's wrapped around its neck, and we're not nearly as stressed out as I feel like you should be.
Well, it's hard to follow horror movie rules, which I think is what's great about this movie, when you have someone who's on the side of the horror, which is Ash.
Right.
Ash is constantly stopping them from doing these extra things that need to be done to stop this thing from coming on board, from killing them, from being able to take over, in essence, the entire ship.
Yeah.
Ash helps this organism because Ash, we find out later, is an android. And it has been programmed with when we find out later the reveal that the crew is expendable. And so that's what his motivation is. So, yes, you're right, but it's really hard to follow these rules when you have one person who is very intelligently undercutting you.
Because Yaphet Kotto is going, hey, why don't we freeze him?
Exactly.
Let's freeze him.
Yeah.
Why aren't we freezing him?
Yeah.
Why are we freezing him?
You're right.
No, you're not.
Every single turn, there's someone who is intelligent about what should be being done to get rid of this thing, and Ash stops them every time.
Yeah. So then, strangely enough, the face sucker disappears.
Yeah.
And we have this really long, again, it's atmospheric, it's slow pace. We're going to try to find the face sucker.
Yeah, that's so great.
From this low angle mostly. And it's always part of what makes things scary is showing space behind the actor.
Yeah.
There's empty space somewhere. So and that forces me, the audience member, to be constantly looking up in that corner. Someone's going to come from that corner. Is it going to come from that corner? Oh, no, it's going to come from over there. No, it's going to come from, because you know it's coming.
Yeah.
And of course, we have our accidentally knock something over.
Right.
And then that tentacle comes down behind Sigourney Weaver and drops on top of her.
Yeah. And I love those moments because those are the moments that, yes, Sigourney Weaver is a tough ass bitch in this movie, and she should be. And people talk about her as, like, I don't know, what you call, like, the female heroine, right? The icon of female heroine. Even though Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, all of them had been around the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Like, but she is noted as this sea change, right?
Absolutely.
In films. But she's still she's still vulnerable. And I think that's important. In that moment when that thing drops down on her, she's screaming. Yeah. As a woman would scream.
As
anybody would scream. Yeah, right, exactly. And I like that because that lets her know, like, lets you know that, yes, she's a human being. She's tough, but she still has her fears and vulnerabilities. And that's great to me. I think that's essential for her character.
Well, and this is, you know, how do we deal with heroism?
Yeah.
So there is Captain Kirk. I love Captain Kirk.
Sure.
And Captain Kirk is a hero.
Yeah.
You know, there's Luke Skywalker. He's a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And then but those people aren't like us.
No.
You know, and then there's watching someone like John McClane.
Yeah.
Who's more like us, who has to overcome fear and has to overcome discouragement and panic and all these things in order to be heroic. And that's who Ripley is.
Yeah.
She's way tougher than me.
Right.
But
me too.
But we also see her humanity in moments like this.
Yes.
Then remarkably, John Hurt wakes up. And we go, yeah, let's go have dinner.
But this is great too, Steve, because this dinner scene is juxtaposed to the scene we had at the beginning where they're all eating food and we get to know them. So we have this, like, real opening beginning scene where they're all together after the hypersleep, and you're getting the sense of the crew and the camaraderie of the crew and the connection and how they speak to each other. And then, boom, we get the dinner scene juxtaposed now with John Hurt after having the face hugger on his face, the character of Kane, yeah.
And this scene is, again, it's very improvisational.
Yeah.
There's really no dialogue that's important. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
No, no, no.
It just means, like, we're talking about, oh, when I get home, I eat this food and blah, blah, blah. And you know it's not important. In fact, even in the mix, the way you do sound mix in general, you always prioritize dialogue.
Yeah.
Is that something's got to be on top of the mix, and and everything else has to come down so that you can have the audience understand every single word that's being said. Because 99% of the time, that's the most important thing.
Right.
It's not true in Alien. In Alien, frequently the sound design and other stuff, the ship sounds, the atmospheric sounds, are coming right up to and sometimes going above the level of the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't quite hear the dialogue, and you realize it's not that important.
No.
Yeah.
And because they're just joshing. And what's great is this great horror movie moment is great, which I think Ridley and Dan O'Bannon might have done just as a kind of wink to horror movie lovers, because the classic thing when you're in any situation is the guy who dies first is the one who says, you know, when I get back, the first thing I'm going to do. And that's exactly what Kane does. It's exactly his line. I can't wait to get back, because when I get back, I'm going to do this.
The first thing that I'm going to do when I get back is to get some decent food.
You can dig it, man. I'll tell you, I've eaten birds from Elizabeth. Then it tastes better. You know what I'm saying?
The other one over there.
You pound down the stuff like this.
Listen, I'd rather be eating something else, but right now,
and he starts to cough and starts to choke, and so begins the most famous scene, I think, from the movie.
There's no question it's the most famous scene in the movie, one of the most iconic scenes in any movie.
In any movie, right?
You choke? What's wrong?
What's wrong? What?
The actors knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
They didn't really know exactly what was going to happen. That was kept from them. And I don't know, like, they're off in their, they kept sending them back to their trailers because they're trying to get the effect just right. They knew, I mean, they'd read the script, so they knew that an alien's going to come out of this chest.
Right.
But they didn't know how.
Yeah.
And they didn't know that there was going to be this big squib blood pack. And what that is, it's a fake torso. And so all of this is really improv. All of their reactions are improv. Veronica Cartwright didn't know she was going to get hit with a huge thing of blood.
She's so great.
She really freaked out.
And she did.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
She fell to the ground in a panic.
Oh, wow.
No, she it was a real freak out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, this is like, how are you going to treat
this
your actors?
Terrible, man.
Because
her reaction is so powerful, too. Oh, so yeah. You get the intended thing you were looking for, because she's like, oh, God. Oh, God. And like, you're just like, oh, man, this is scary as hell.
And there's a difference, too. Like, I've been on stage and had to do a slap, you know, and been slapped.
Sure.
And I said, just slap me. You know, like,
wow, you really did.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Method
boy.
This wasn't a, like, it wasn't like a huge guy. It was a woman.
Okay.
And I was like, give me a slap. And that was fine, you know. Well, there was one time I was doing a fight scene on stage with my friend Jeff, and we started, and this is a guy I had done martial arts with forever. So we did a big, there was handsprings in it and like a huge like acrobatic fight scene.
Right.
And I had him just kick me in the chest. Now, not hard, super hard, but we rehearsed this thing for weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a big bruise across the chest.
That's why they call it stage combat, Steve.
Yeah. And then, and then at the last moment, Jeff only could do two nights of it. And my friend Steve Jones had to come in and replace him. He hadn't done the practice, and Steve kicked me in the head on stage with a jump kick.
Yeah,
almost knocked me out. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
All right.
Unfortunately, in that scene, I was dragged off the stage on purpose.
Oh, good.
Because I don't know if I could have gotten up. I was pretty groggy.
You there, man?
All right.
Yeah. So
but we digress.
That's right. So the blood pack happens. Yeah.
And we get to see I forget the name they have him for, the chest popper or whatever, the little alien.
Yeah, the little alien comes out.
Yeah, the little puppet, and he runs away. And now we have to go hunt the little alien.
Yes.
Well, what we think is a little alien.
Yes. Right. This thing grows quickly, man.
Yeah. The physics of Alien is not really, we don't get into it too much.
No. But we should find out, because like, it's so quick from his little baby sheds his skin, it becomes this like 6 foot tall monster.
Yeah, I mean,
within a matter of moments.
Yeah.
It's not that much time.
Yeah, not at all. So maybe he's, I don't know, nuclear powered or something. I don't know how he gets big that
acid
fast.
Powered, yeah.
All right, so we go on our hunt for the chest burster.
That's what it's called. That's right, yeah.
Chest burster.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. Chest burster.
Say that five times.
Yeah, all right. So we go on our hunt for him, and of course we know this isn't going to go right.
No.
Because we know what kind of movie we're in.
Right.
And then the classic horror movie things is someone goes and splits off. And we have Harry Dean Stanton going off to find the cat. Now, we know he's dead.
Right. And right off, you say it's a classic movie moment, followed by another classic movie moment, which is we think it's the alien. It's a cat.
Right.
We get the fake scare, which causes the guy to go off on his own, which is the first moment that I was like, oh, this is a little bit of a trope that you send the guy to go get the cat, because everyone's so scared. Why would you send someone off by themselves, you know?
Well, part of it is they don't know they're in a horror movie.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, Steve. They think they're still looking for something small,
they think
not something big.
Thing,
right,
and
right.
They haven't quite gone to, and why would you expect that little thing to turn into this 7-foot
That's true. You say very good point.
Thing with two mouths.
Hanging off a black chain.
Yeah.
Like it does.
So we haven't really talked about Harry Dean Stanton yet.
Ugh.
He's such an unusual actor, and particularly in the like mid to late 70s, early 80s. He's in so many, you know, Escape from New York and all these movies where he plays these weird, quirky Harry Dean Stanton kind of roles.
Yeah, and shows up in things like Pretty in Pink and random movies like that, Repo Man and Paris, Texas.
Man,
yeah,
right.
These kinds of things. He's great in these roles. He's almost an American John Hurt.
I'm just going to say exactly.
Yeah, were you? Okay, yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, I was
point.
Just having this because he is who he is,
yep.
And he comes into these supporting parts. And by the way, and listening to him on the commentary track, and he has a band, I think he still plays,
right?
Like a local blues band that plays in Los Angeles. And he is a weird, quirky, gruff, I don't give a shit kind of character.
That's why you cast him.
And that is what he is.
Yeah.
So he goes off. And one of the things I noticed, and I checked up on it, is that everyone's very sweaty and wet.
Yeah.
So what that is, it's not water, because water doesn't catch the light the way Ridley Scott wanted.
Oh.
It's glycerin, KY jelly.
Oh, nasty.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Which apparently Sigourney Weaver had an allergic reaction to it.
Oh, shoot.
Mixed with cat hair. So that's a strange thing. But anyway, because you could see the way that liquid catches the light is really, really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And he's going around, and we go into this room where it's like dripping and chains are hanging. And you're like, what kind of ship is this? You know, and there's sort of this weird, why is there a drippy room on a spaceship? And yet that's part of what makes it so cool.
Yeah. And then we see, and what you said earlier, Steve, is great. Giving depth of field behind the actor so that you can have the alien hanging off the black chains.
Right.
And it's brilliant because it's so, you don't notice it at first, which is what's so great about the design of Giger's design in the film. It's and the design of the ship. The design of the ship juxtaposed with the design of the alien. The alien can slide into these little things in the background, these little that then completely almost be camouflaged, and you only notice it at the last second or at the last minute.
Well, and I think the first time you see the movie, when you don't know that design, I don't think you see it at all.
Right.
I think once you know the alien design and you watch the movie the second time, you're like, oh my God.
Yes.
Because it's a silent, very silent shot.
I agree with you completely.
And quiet and silence is used really well.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else I wanted to talk about in relationship to that. There's in art terms, you talk about the way you space, deep space, flat space, idea of limited space, which is sort of a mix of spaces. And one of the other ones is ambiguous space.
Mm-hmm.
And what ambiguous space means is essentially that I'm looking at some and I don't know what the fuck I'm seeing.
Yeah.
That's what ambiguous space is. And that alien shot where it's in the foreground in the chains is a good example of it. And ambiguous space is used quite a bit in this film. There's shots where you're like, am I upside down? What am I looking through? Is this a big thing, a small thing? You can't really tell. And what's always cool is when it's a great thing to use in horror films because you want the audience disoriented.
Yeah.
And then when ambiguous space resolves itself, and you realize, oh, I'm looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really powerful thing. And that happens quite a bit in this film. And then we have, you know, the moment in a Roadrunner cartoon where the coyote runs off the cliff.
Yeah.
And until he looks down, he doesn't fall.
That's right.
And then he has the realization that he is off the cliff and he looks down.
Yeah.
And of course, that's when he's doomed.
Right.
That's what Harry Dean Stanton has when he sees the alien.
Yeah.
There's this sort of like, you're in deep trouble. You're in deep trouble.
Right.
And then he looks and then he realizes I'm off the cliff. Then we have that big face of the alien and that double mouth.
Yeah, man.
That's some weird design.
What a great introduction to that design, too, to have it.
Yeah.
To have this like little thing. And it's the two moments, him and Veronica Cartwright are the two moments where they're both frozen in fear.
Yeah.
You know? So,
Well, and honestly,
because you
imagine
seeing
that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. In person, yeah.
Well, and this is the thing. We can't imagine seeing these designs for the first time.
Yeah.
Because by the time I saw the movie,
I had
seen the alien design.
Right.
I knew what it looked like.
Right.
I can't imagine being in a movie theater in 1979 and seeing that thing come at you. I cannot imagine what that would have been like.
I agree.
Much less being Harry Dean Stanton and seeing that thing coming at you. I mean, that is terrifying.
Yeah, agreed.
So, by the way, this is an hour and 8 minutes in. This is the first real kill. I mean, yes, we have Kane's death earlier.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing. This is the first. So that's more than halfway through the film. Mm-hmm. That's what the pace of this film is.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I think, again, we talk about how movies have changed. I'm not saying we don't make good movies today. I think we definitely do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't make this movie anymore.
Not really.
Because we don't have the patience.
Yeah.
You know, we just like movies. The movies move fast.
Yeah.
And I don't watch a lot of horror movies. You do. But my sense is they move a lot faster than this.
They do. And the payoffs are quicker. You know, and you get
And there are lots of them.
And there are lots of them. And you get into it a lot quicker, too. Don't Breathe is one that if you haven't seen Don't Breathe, it's very correlative to this.
Mm.
It's a slow building horror, which is fantastic. And Stephen Lang is great in that film. But yeah, so Stanton is gone. Yaphet Kotto and Sigourney run into the scene. They see the blood on the ground. They look up.
Blood's dripping down from the ceiling.
Yeah, which blood's on the camera as well, which gets you that, you know, first point of view type of feeling, which is great.
And now we're into, like, we got to go get this thing. We have a meeting of the crew, and the plan is Dallas is going to go off, Tom Skerritt, and scare him with a flamethrower, and we're going to send him out a airlock.
Right.
We know this plan isn't going to go well.
As soon as Tom Skerritt said he's going to go into the vent by himself, you know he's the next victim.
Dallas, you're going to have to hold your position for a minute. I've lost the signal.
What? You sure?
Look around. Are you sure that it's not there? I mean, it's got to be around there somewhere.
Check that out, Lambert. You may be getting interference.
Dallas, are you sure there is no sign of it? I mean, it is there. It's got to be around there.
Am I Claire Lambert? I want to get the hell out of here.
Oh, God, it's moving right towards you. Move, get out of there. Don't you move. Dad, move, Dad. Move, Dad, get out.
Dallas?
No.
Dallas?
And again, it's very much sort of Jaws in the barrels, mm-hmm. is we have beeps and lights.
Yes.
And not the alien.
Yep.
Is that the more you see the alien, the less scary he's going to be.
Yeah.
And so we don't see him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we should say, by the way, that the alien is played by Balaji Badejo, who is like an art student.
Oh, wow.
Good, more art students.
Yes, of course.
Might be Nigerian.
Okay.
That Ridley Scott found, and he's this guy that's 6'10". He's 6'10 and super skinny. Super, super skinny, and has strangely long arms and legs. And Ridley Scott went, that's the guy I can put in a suit. And they had to do a whole body mold of his body mm-hmm. in order to make this suit just fit him just perfectly.
Yeah.
And it is really disturbing.
Yeah, it is.
Which it is just a dude in the suit, mm-hmm. just like Creature from the Black Lagoon or Godzilla or anything else.
Right.
But it's kind of a special one.
Yeah, it is. And I think there are certain moments that betray it now going back in 2017, like when Tom Skerritt, we just left off where Tom Skerritt's in the vent with the fire and we see the little beeps coming, which is great. And Veronica Cartwright is so perfect at conveying that kind of like, oh my God, fear, you know? And that thing is beeping, coming closer and closer. And then we see the shot of the fire and we see the two hands reach out, which I think is a little cheesy for me going back, but I forgive it because the entire movie is so fantastic.
Well, and
this idea that hands reaching out, yeah.
it's only a few frames.
Yeah.
You know, I think every frame you added to it, it would get cheesier and cheesier.
Agreed. Yeah. Completely.
Only show it for a couple seconds.
Yep.
By the way, Veronica Cartwright was upset that she's like, I don't want to play this.
She was.
I mean, for good reasons, it seems like. I don't want to play this. Why am I so scared? I want to play a stronger character.
Yeah.
And I love the way smart directors talk to actors sometimes, which is, and it's not that this isn't true, but he said, no, it's good because you are the audience.
Yes.
And that made her feel really good.
She is.
And therefore she went and didn't feel bad about playing the scared character. Now, is what Ridley Scott says true? Absolutely. It's 100% true. Is it a way to manipulate your actors into shutting up and doing what you wanted to do? I think it's that too.
Yes, probably.
And sometimes that's your job as a director. Is your job as a director is to get the actors to do what you want them to do.
Right.
That doesn't mean you always tell them the truth.
Yeah.
Now, I don't put them in suits that don't have ventilation systems, but I will manipulate them. So
you heard it here first.
Yeah. Please. Well, that's the job. So by Tom Skerritt, you're dead.
Yes.
I think we all knew that was coming.
Yes.
Yeah. Although in the director's cut, he actually is not quite dead yet.
No, which is a great scene, I think. When we
and that's a director's. That's not in the theatrical version.
Yeah. Damn it. That's such a great scene.
This is one. And Ridley Scott doesn't like the director's cut.
I don't understand. Like, the film is like fantastic. Scenes, yeah. It's an extra 3 minutes, but it's good.
Yeah. And now, finally, Ripley is in charge.
Yes.
How come I don't hear anybody saying nothing around
I'm
this
thinking.
Place?
Unless somebody has got a better idea, we'll proceed with Dallas's plan.
What? And end up like the others? Oh, no, you're out of your mind.
You got a better idea?
And she's going to continue the Tom Skerritt plan, but with one thing she wants to find out is what is Mother, which is the name of the ship computer, and Ash doing?
Right.
Ash? Any suggestions from you or Mother?
No, we're still collating.
You what? You're still collating? I find that hard to believe.
What would you like me to do?
Just what you've been doing, Ash. Nothing. I've got access to Mother now, and I'll get my own answers, thank you.
All right.
Because Ash is continually been disobeying, been pushing to keep the alien. She goes into really cool design, sort of the computer room, and finds out that Ash has been given orders to bring back this alien at all costs, and the crew is expendable.
Steve, to me, this is the moment where I think we understand this. This film is a product of the 70s. This idea of Nixon, this idea of not trusting the government, this idea of not trusting the people in charge, big business, this kind of thing. It comes through in Alien. It comes through in a number of films that come out through the 70s. And even in 69 with 2001, this idea of computers being in charge, not you. This fear that you are not as in charge as you think you are as a human being. And once again, we have this situation. A, it's called Mother, which is really was this whole idea of like being in charge, and this whole, and then her reaction to it, her seeing that you're her expendable, and her, and once again, we have this vulnerable, angry reaction from Sigourney Weaver's character, from Ripley, as she throws Ash against the wall, and is really, and Ash's reaction, Ian Holm's reaction is so great in the movie, because he's almost like unsettled by what's happening to him. He can't conceive of what's happening to him.
His performance of being a robot is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's not, and he's not a robot the way Data in Star Trek is.
No.
Or C-3PO or, you know, and droids, robots, I understand we have differences, but
they actually
call him a robot in the movie,
yes,
which is why I'm using that term.
Yaphet Kotto does.
But his style, it's because he's this weird organic, not organic thing, mm-hmm, and his movement and his facial and his emotional reactions are so peculiar. They're not emotionless.
Yeah.
He has emotions.
Yes.
And he is genuinely scary when he's throwing Sigourney Weaver around.
Because there's no emotion behind it.
Yeah.
He's just doing it. And when the slow pace to where he builds up to wrapping the magazine into a roll to shove into her mouth, he's almost questioning the decision of doing it, and then decides, no, I have to do this, because he's glitching. He's glitching because she affected him by throwing him against the wall like that.
It's like you could see him struggling with the Asimov three rules of robotics.
Exactly,
you know what I mean? Like, it's like he's got contradictory instructions.
Yes.
And he's been told you have to sacrifice the crew, but he's not supposed to. And,
right.
And then we have this Yaphet Kotto comes in, and we're trying to stop him. And then knocking that guy's head off is really shocking.
So great.
Even knowing it's coming, it's shocking.
Yes, yes. And we should talk about Yaphet for just a little bit.
I love Yaphet.
Yaphet is one of these guys who is so great through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I mean, Across 110th Street, Alien.
Midnight Run.
He shows up in these amazing movies and does great performances. He's one of these very strong African-American actors that no one fucking talks about.
No.
And he was so great in everything he was in, and powerful, and gave no quarter in any role he was in.
And he is what he is, like all these guys, like John Hurt, like Harry Dean Stanton.
Yes.
Like, he is just, this is the kind of, this, you're casting this guy.
Yep.
You know, and Ian Holm too.
Yeah.
Like, what a great casting choice to cast this small, somewhat round, kind of nerdy looking guy as the scary robot.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the robot not in the original script.
Oh, wow.
That was added. That might have been a Walter Hill idea.
Okay.
Added much later.
That's brilliant.
O'Bannon, the screenwriter, hated it.
What?
Yeah. And the reason
makes the film.
Well, here's the thing. When I write my script how I write it, that's how it's fucking supposed to be. And if you change it, you're wrong.
That's fair.
So we have to start with that.
It's
very hard to overcome that. And he wanted it to be a perfect little monster movie.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. That's key to the film.
Yep.
It elevates it so much.
Absolutely.
Because it's one more thing to have to deal with.
Right.
And so now we are going to get on the shuttle. And we're going to blow up the ship.
Well, first they bring Ash back to life.
Right. Oh, they resurrect that
Which
head.
Is awesome.
Yeah.
And great cuts, because you can immediately tell it's a dummy and her struggling to sit it upright. And then they cut immediately to his head, through a thing, through the table or whatever. And
covered in milk.
Which is great design, great makeup and whatever. And the adjustment of his voice. This is great to put it through a processor to make it sound almost very computer-like.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity.
And then still the smirk at the end when he says,
I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies.
Oh, it's such a great fuck you. It's such a great fuck you.
Right.
Which brings to end this tension that has been going on between him and Ripley through the entire movie, you know, and it's so great.
And then Yaphet Kotto just burns him.
Yes, he does.
Rightly so at this point.
I absolutely agree.
I'm absolutely with that choice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we're going to blow up the ship.
Yeah.
And again, you're just like, you watch Yaphet Kotto and Veronica Cartwright, and they're banging things around, and she's just completely freaked out.
She's nuts, yeah.
And it's just like, oh, you're going to die.
You're going to die.
Yeah. But what's great, what they do so well is both Veronica Cartwright's helplessness when the alien shows up, Yaphet Kotto's like, get out of the way, get out of the way, and Ripley hearing it and being too far away to help. And running to help, and the helplessness of the way that whole event is filmed.
Yeah. And once again, that moment where Yaphet doesn't do what needs to be done because he doesn't want to kill Veronica Cartwright in the process. But in the end, it's a noble thing what he does, but it leads to his death.
Right.
You know?
Well, and it's like, I can't imagine in a matter of seconds, in a high stress situation, making the decision to kill this woman.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
You know, that's tough.
And it's great drama to the film. It's great tragedy to the film because he dies in a noble way, because Parker is a noble character, I think, through the whole film. His ideas of what should be done are correct at every moment. Even when he's bitching about a bonus or whatever, he's kind of disrespectful to Sigourney at the beginning, but he's a noble character throughout the film because he wants to survive.
Of course.
And he knows what needs to be done to survive. And even in that moment, he cannot kill Veronica Cartwright because he just can't have, he's not within him to do that.
Yeah. Right.
And he dies trying to save her by running into the alien and trying to fight it, you know?
Well, and it goes back to what we've been saying from the beginning, which is these are ordinary people.
Yeah.
This is not what we're going to see in Aliens, where we have the toughest, you know, space marines in the world.
Yeah.
This is like, these are just some guys working on a cargo ship that get into this situation and are doing the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then things get really chaotic now. The lights are strobing, the camera's handheld. We're in these strange POV shots. We're running through corridors.
Wait, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think Veronica Cartwright's death is somewhat sexual?
But this is one of the things in the film.
Because the alien wraps around her leg and moves slowly up, and then we hear
There's no question that that is... Here's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
That is not her leg.
Oh, okay.
That is Harry Dean Stanton's leg. That's a shot from... I'm glad you brought it up. That's a shot from his death that they didn't use, and they brought it in this for exactly the reason you're talking about. And there's a strange sexual element
in
alien movies. Veronica Cartwright's description of the Giger art is that you're walking into penises and vaginas.
Wow.
You know, that's what she says.
Okay.
And I never think of it this way.
Neither do I.
But clearly the filmmakers do, because when we get to Sigourney in the shuttle at the end, there is Sigourney Weaver talks about a sexual element.
Yes, there is. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so it's like, oh, wow, there's some weird, some weird stuff in there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so, this brings up a question I want to ask you, which is, in this chaos of Sigourney's, first she's trying to stop blowing up the ship.
Mm-hmm.
She fails to do that, and then she's going to rush to the shuttle.
Yeah.
The alien runs into the cat.
Yes.
Does the alien move the cat as bait or use that?
No, I think he moves it out of the way because the cat is inconsequential. He can't eat it. He doesn't want to kill it because it's irrelevant to him. He wants the human, the bigger prey. I think he's after the bigger prey. So he just smacks the cat out of the way.
I think it could be that.
Yeah, that's what I got.
But it's also Sigourney is going to have to look around for the cat.
Possibly.
And I wonder, because one of the things I wonder about the alien, how intelligent is this creature?
Well, Ash refers to that when he gets brought back to life and says he's a perfect hunting machine, right? Like Jaws. They say that in Jaws.
Right.
He's a perfect hunt, you know, the
swims and eats and makes
exactly the respect that Quint has for a shark is it's a perfect eating machine. And so that kind of thing is what we're talking about here. In same thing. And you're right, it's got a big head for a reason, must have a massive brain, maybe, and it can figure out this situation. And maybe he's using the cat as bait for Sigourney.
Yeah. This whole perfect eating machine, we're gonna talk about, by the way, we believe Jaws is coming up.
Yes.
So just so you know, it's in the works.
Yeah.
Jaws is a movie that I have very strong feelings about.
Yes, you do.
We're going to get into this perfect eating machine thing because that is a ridiculous silly. Like, what is that? I don't know what that means.
As a guy who directed a documentary of sharks, please, you're going to break down all these things I know.
Because what's interesting, if this was a Star Trek movie, we would try to talk to the animal.
Of course.
In fact, this is, you know, there's a Star Trek episode, very famous, Devil in the Dark.
Devil in the Dark.
Which is about this creature that's in these mines. It has these eggs and it's killing all these miners.
Right.
And really, it's just trying to protect its eggs.
Right.
But they think it's an evil monster and they find out that it's an intelligent creature.
Because Spock mind melds. Because
Spock mind melds with the big, you know, carpet thing whatever that thing is. So if this was Star Trek, that's what we'd be doing.
Right.
This is not Star Trek.
Nope.
This thing is never treated that it might be intelligent.
Yeah.
And yet some of its behavior seems like Is it trapping them? Is it, you know?
Oh, it's hunting them. I think it's quite intelligent. Right. So you might be right, because it knows where to hide. It knows how to hide, and it knows how to unsettle everyone else.
Well, and this brings us to the space, to the shuttle.
Yes.
So Sigourney makes it into the shuttle. She pulls away at the last seconds as things are counting down. Mm-hmm. There's an explosion. The Nostromo blows up, and she goes, I got you.
Yeah.
And we think it's the end of the movie.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's not the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. And here's a couple of interesting things. So first of all, this sequence in the shuttle is not in the original script.
Oh.
It was supposed to be blown up in the Nostromo. Okay. While they're shooting, near the end of the shoot, Ridley Scott goes to Fox and says, I need more money. I want to shoot 4 more days. And they go, what? You're already over budget. No, you can't have any more money. And then he pitches them what he wants to do, and they give him more money.
Oh, nice.
And what I'm wondering, is this the quote-unquote first fourth act in film history?
Ooh.
I don't know that it is. It's the first one I can think of.
It's a valid question.
Where we think the movie is over.
Yeah.
Everything is wrapped up as if the movie is over, and the movie is not over.
Right.
Is it the first one?
Maybe, brother. It's a question that I don't know if I can answer right now on the spot without doing some research, but you can make a case. You can absolutely make a case.
Because this then has to put it into my list of movies, the great movies that ruin Hollywood. You know, which is the, is that, because here's this.
No, the movies don't ruin Hollywood. The people imitating these things ruin Hollywood.
Of course, of course. That is the key.
Yes.
But that's a longer title for my this list.
Sure. For your future
great
book.
Great movies who other people imitated poorly, thus ruining Hollywood, does not sound as good as great movies that ruin Hollywood. It's called brevity.
Fair, fair.
Because that fourth act structure.
Yeah.
Oh no, there's going to be one more thing.
Yeah.
Which we saw, you know,
Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, any number of things.
Yeah. Die Hard 3, like all these
even
movies.
Friday the 13th.
Yeah. It's like, oh, he's dead. No, he's not dead. And then you have to have the fifth act,
Halloween,
or the sixth, like, oh no, he's dead. No, he's not dead. No, he's
right.
dead. No, he's not dead.
Right.
It's like, just stop.
Just stop already.
Yeah, so we end up, she's quietly and slowly getting undressed.
Yeah.
And there is such, because we know it's not over at this point.
Right.
That you know what kind of movie you're in. The movie, the music is still scary.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, do have to talk about Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah.
This is another great score. We talked about him before with Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
This is another really great score from him.
Yeah.
I mean, the tension of it, the dissonance of it, it's really, really powerful.
Yeah.
And there's something very vulnerable in its privacy about Sigourney Weaver getting undressed.
Yeah.
It's really creepy and scary.
Yeah, and she's wearing white panties, and they barely fit, and they're tight around her hips.
Yeah.
And then when she bends over or like leans over, it turns out you see her ass crack completely.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting choice, right? I used to think it was sexual, but this is a person who's trying to kind of like get into, like, because when they woke up out of deep sleep, they're all wearing barely anything. So like, well, it's a lot. She's about to go into deep sleep.
What I would say is it's very private.
Yes.
You feel like a voyeur.
Yes. Agreed.
You feel like, oh, I'm not supposed to be seeing this.
Right, right.
That's fair. And part of it is because it is not the perfectly sexy whatever.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, which is being served up for me, the audience,
right,
to ogle,
right,
at the beautiful woman. This is... It's a woman getting undressed.
Right.
What are you looking at this for?
Right.
You know?
It's a good point.
And there's also this thing that Sigourney Weaver, we talked about before, is that this weird sexual nature of this last moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so as she's doing this, there's this moment where you see this weird shape in the shuttle, which she doesn't see. And you're going like, is that its head?
Is that
its head? And it is.
So great.
The alien is hiding in this thing. Here's my question. Why is it not attacking her? I never understand.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
Because it's a long time. I mean, it's not like the thing is slow.
It's not in the script for her to take.
Yeah.
I would say. No, but I think it's also, what's the rush?
Yeah.
Right?
It's
going to wait till the shuttle takes off a little while, and then it's going to do what it's going to do, and maybe it's going to go. Like, if you say this thing's intelligent, then it's already figuring out how to go and create. Because what we saw before she gets in that shuttle, which we didn't talk about yet or in depth, is like she goes down and sees Tom Skerritt.
Right.
He's essentially creating a breeding ground for his future aliens or for something to occur out of there. And so he's probably going to wait to do the same with Sigourney.
Right.
And so he's waiting for the right time.
Again, as we said, that his job is to make little aliens,
right?
And that's what he's going to try to do.
Yeah.
And the hand jumps
out.
Yeah. And she goes and backs up and puts herself into a spacesuit.
Yep.
And I think that scene is so well done.
Yeah, I agree.
Of her in holding down the panic and having to do this physical thing that is difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably not easy to get in a spacesuit under normal circumstances.
Agreed.
And it's one of those things that in action films tend to be that you've got a character who's shot and wounded and doing all this stuff, and yet they still are running around and doing everything with ease.
Yeah.
And this is a scene where it's not easy, and that's part of what makes it scary and really strong.
Yeah.
Is she's trying to do something hard, and the hard thing is put on this outfit.
Yeah.
I know that sounds, but to me, it's just a beautifully done scene.
Agreed.
Opens up the air vent, uses, I don't know why she has a harpoon gun.
Just in case.
Because that's something that comes up. Uses the harpoon gun, shoots it out, but now it's attached, and she closes the airlock in time. And then I just love burning him up in that engine and the thruster.
Because it tries to stay alive to climb in through the engine thruster. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, do you know how they did that effect?
No.
So the engine's just like, how are we going to shoot this thruster at him? It's water.
Oh.
This is Ridley Scott's idea.
Wow.
It's water pouring out of the engine, really brightly lit by a big arc light behind it.
Yeah.
And looking through and shot in slow motion. And it and this is all Ridley Scott's idea.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it's plasma. And then someone said, what's plasma? And he says, I don't know, but it sounds good. Yeah, and that's how they do that effect.
That's great.
And now we really have reached the end of the film.
Yeah, and I love this ending with because the film changes. Like it the scope of it, it becomes like almost Cinerama in its way. And then you hear this like very operatic score that's like, oh, okay, we're all right. We're okay.
Yeah.
And it's a relief operatic score, which we hear every once in a while.
It's beautiful
in films
and
like
harmonious,
this.
Unlike anything we've heard throughout the film.
Yep.
Yeah. Whew. Okay.
What a great film, dude.
Final thoughts on Alien.
Oh, my gosh. If you haven't seen this in a long time, just like Steve hasn't seen it in a while, and I hadn't seen it in a few months at least or over a year, it is so great to go back and rediscover this movie. It is one of the greatest horror noir films that you're ever going to see. And I say noir because condensation, water is prevalent through the film. It's shot in a lot of darkness. You don't know what's happening next. You don't know where who's going to turn on you. You have betrayal. You have everything that leads, and you have this incredible creature that you cannot overcome, this incredible thing you don't see coming. And once again, it's from a higher power. You know, in all noirs, it's a one person against this thing or a couple of people against this thing, and the thing is bigger than they actually think it is, and they have to fight it. And so to me, what's so amazing about this film is from top to bottom, it takes you on an amazing ride. It takes its time. It does not insult the audience in any way, shape, or form. It makes you come to it, and it really pays off in so many ways throughout the whole film with the acting, with the directing, with the design, and with the score. Absolutely.
Yeah, so for me, while this film will never quite live up to my sister's telling of the story when I was 11, what's interesting to me, in all seriousness about this film, is like a lot of great films, there's nothing like it.
Yes.
There's nothing like this film.
Agreed.
Even though this film spawned a whole bunch of sequels and a whole world, comic books and all that stuff, none of them are like this.
Yeah.
That this combines in this very strange way this kind of 70s style of acting and realism, and even this sort of Robert Altman way of approaching performance, along with this unbelievable design sense, with this very spare use of dialogue and mostly visual storytelling, beautiful sound design, and it's a very, very simple movie. Like, if you're going to actually break down the actions, not that much happened. There wasn't that much for my sister to remember to tell this story in real time because it's very, very simple.
Yeah.
And yet it has such lasting power. And this is what we see, I think, when Ridley Scott is good.
Yeah.
Which he isn't always.
No, right, true.
You know, I think to me, he's one of these directors who he'll make a great movie and then there'll be two or three that you're like, just don't care about them at all.
Yep.
And maybe you think he's done. There's not going to, and then. Just another great
movie. Martian shows up.
Is that when he's good, he gets all those elements to work together in just the right way, the visual elements, the character elements, the story elements. And when he's and the visual elements are almost always good in his films, but it's the other stuff, that kind of magical stuff, which is so apparent in Alien that sometimes isn't there.
It's a masterpiece, man.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic film.
And I love the quote on the poster, "In space, no one can hear you scream."
That is a great line.
Brilliant, man.
I don't know what the top 10, movie taglines are.
Yeah, but that's
right up there.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So that's what we think of Alien. Obviously, we had a lot to say.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear what you think of Alien. You can visit us on Facebook. We're at The Cinephiles. That's CineFiles. But throw away the dash if you're on Stitcher, mm-hmm. because Stitcher doesn't like dashes. It's just C-I-N-E, new word, F-I-L-E-S. That's how you find us there. Please subscribe to us on Stitcher or on iTunes. That's where most people have found us.
Yeah.
And while you're doing some subscribing on iTunes, you know what you might want to do? Take an extra minute. There's a little button there that says review. Hit that review button. Put in 5 stars. Yes, 5 stars. I think this review deserves it.
I agree.
And then write really nice things about both John and I.
Yes.
You know you want to.
We need it sometimes. We're nice to read compliments.
Very needy people.
Yeah, it's true.
And that would really help us out. In all seriousness, those reviews help bring us up in the ratings, helps people find the show. It makes it much more likely that we get to keep doing this. And we mm-hmm. really love doing this. And as we said at the beginning of the show, one of the things we love most is communicating with you. So if you want to communicate with me, reach out to me on Twitter at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
You can always find me at The Rocha Says, R-O-C-H-A, and on Twitter and on Instagram.
Yeah. I'm not quite on Instagram. Maybe at some point I'll do that.
Yeah. You are, but you're not active.
Yeah. I have an account.
Yes. I can tag you, but you don't ever respond.
Have you? You probably have.
Many times.
Oh, well, yeah. No,
that's all right.
I don't know. So maybe. All right. Maybe I'll have to start getting on Instagram.
Yeah.
Anyway, but we digress.
Right.
And we are going to digress right into the end of the show. That's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.